So I'm Dr. Bob Gill. Thank you for inviting me to speak to you today. So I just want to recap my experience of what happened from 2019 with the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the whole episode came on the back of me campaigning against NHS privatisation, which is clearly not in the public interest and done by consecutive governments. And then we had a supposed health crisis whereby there seemed to be unlimited amount of money to be thrown at what was presented as saving lives, which didn't fit in with everything else I knew about what they were doing to public services and the effects of austerity. So it didn't add up quite early on to me. And then I came across an interview on a YouTube podcast done by Ralph Nader, who was formerly a presidential candidate. He was responsible for a lot of safety legislation in America back in the 60s, and he was interviewing a geneticist quite early on in 2020. And he said, look, he's looked at the sequence of the coronavirus and said he's never seen anything like it occurring naturally. And one thing he drew the attention to was there was a series of genetic sequences that were repeating for 100 or even 200 times. And the chances of that happening in nature are infinitely small. So to him, it looked like something that had been created in a lab. So that was interesting. And soon after that, we were hearing about possibilities of lockdowns, the hunt for a vaccine. There was certainly a lot of media hysteria and fear propaganda, as it turned out, looking back. And that's my first recollection is what was happening in northern Italy, where some of the intensive care units were flooded with largely elderly patients hooked up to ventilators, and what looked like dreadful scenes with doctors struggling to cope with what seemed like an avalanche of very extremely sick people. But also in early 2020, we had the Diamond Princess, which was a cruise ship, a tourist cruise ship, on which there was an outbreak of the COVID-19. And again, this was plastered all over the news and presented as some sort of catastrophic event. But later on, I found out that actually the death rate for these generally elderly tourists on that ship was in fact very low. And it turned out that had more detail or attention been paid to the Diamond Princess and the results of the infection on the passengers, that it would have been realized very early on that actually the fatality rate of coronavirus 19 was not particularly high. In fact, what it turned out to be is, from serious epidemiological studies reported by Professor John Ioannidis of Stanford University, he produced details saying, well, the overall death rate from COVID was similar to the flu. However, the difference was that there was a significant increase in the elderly populations. And later on, we know from UK data that the average age of people dying from coronavirus was 80 or 81. So this was not the same picture that was presented to us night after night on our televisions and all over the radios. So the other thing that struck me quite early on was what the BBC were up to. Now, my experience of the BBC was learned the hard way when I started campaigning against NHS privatisation I realized from personal experience that there was a significant amount of censorship on the issue. And one example was a huge demonstration I went to in Manchester around 2012, 2013, during the Conservative Party conference, which was obviously heavily covered by the media. And we, the marchers, the protesters, I think they numbered about 50,000, one of the biggest demos in Manchester's history, I was told. We walked past the conference centre and we saw the world's TV cameras, and all they had to do was turn their cameras around and point at us. And I was quite hopeful because I thought, well, this is bound to be on the news. In fact, I rang my wife. I said, "This is great news. Hopefully the issue will be exposed on the 10 o'clock news on the BBC." And I got home before it went on air, and to my shock, there was not a mention of this massive protest. Now, that was a key moment when I started to realize, well, if they're not covering this, there's a lot of other things I suspect they're not covering.
Yeah, let me just interrupt you quickly there, Bob, because what people don't necessarily realise is that they don't know what they're not being told.
Absolutely. A phrase I've heard John Pilger, the sort of esteemed journalist, quote. He said, "Censorship by omission." And unfortunately, there's a lot of that goes on. So, in terms of the NHS, we are never presented with the facts that the NHS actually no longer exists in it, the legal form set up back in 1948. That has been totally dismantled. And what we have now is something replicating American Medicaid and Medicare, which is publicly funded, but increasingly going to be largely privately provided and controlled. So that's just a bit of a diversion. But so I was extremely skeptical as to and suspicious of why there was a daily death count being presented to us on the BBC News at 10 every night. Now, the BBC, by that point in my eyes, was more or less a state mouthpiece and wouldn't really do anything to upset the government. And we also know there are many links between the senior executives who control the BBC and the Conservative Party. So this dramatic revelations of how many thousands of people are dying every day, it confused me. I thought, what is actually going on here? Because for the first time that I can remember, the BBC seems to be doing a job of holding the government to account and exposing what I believe to be a catastrophic failure, which was actually contributed to by what they've done to the NHS in terms of shrinking capacity and causing a workforce crisis. In a health emergency, you need hospitals, you need beds, you need doctors and nurses, but they've spent decades decimating the service. So I thought maybe this might expose the failures of privatisation. But actually, it later transpired, and we know through some journalistic exposés that between the government, between senior people and the health secretary and others in the cabinet at the time, they had a project which was designed to create fear in the public. And there was a famous WhatsApp message from Matt Hancock, the then health secretary, and I believe the phrase was "scare the pants off the people," and it was a newspaper headline at the time. And again, I found out as the pandemic went on that a lot of the public messaging was designed by behavioral psychologists. Now, this is an abuse of psychology because what they're doing is not helping anyone, but they're assisting the manipulation through messaging and through propaganda and repetition to drive people's fear and later on to drive support for lockdowns and also drive support for mass vaccination.
Now, let me just quickly intercede, because we also had this phrase, which I remember well, Isabel Oakeshott. Not everyone approves of her work as a journalist, but she did get out many of these WhatsApp messages that were sent around the government. They talked about deploying a new variant, which almost sounds as if the variant hasn't occurred naturally. It's being deployed by the government. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Yeah, and that could mean deploy it as a weapon of propaganda as well, just to ratchet up the fear and to keep the people queuing up for their supposedly phenomenally effective vaccine.
Yeah, and I mean, it certainly shows that their mindset was, rather than just being a government there looking after the population as they're supposed to do, they saw the whole exercise mainly to do with information, propaganda, and, you know, maybe they were all being run by the Nudge Unit. Anyway, I don't want to interrupt you too much, Bob, because I know, you know, because we're now 5 years down the line. It's very interesting to hear what, you know, what, because we all learn from these experiences, what you've learned.
Yeah, the other thing that became apparent is that they threw out what was accepted public health protocol, science-based protocol. They pushed paper vaccine, paper masks on everybody, for which there's no evidence. If you have a airborne virus, they provide zero extra protection. We know that preceding 2019, no public health authority in the world recommended locking down for an airborne virus. The locking down was actually economically, rationally catastrophic in terms of the hit households took financially, the disruption of children's education, and what it did to redistribute wealth upwards. So we saw the closure of many small and medium-sized businesses who couldn't cope with the lockdown and the financial impact, and a transfer of economic activity and wealth to companies such as Amazon. And this was more dramatic in the US. So what it ended up doing was funneling money to very big tech companies and others, and protecting industries that actually didn't really need protection, and also handed out COVID grants and financial support to bogus companies that were set up without much due diligence being done. In fact, one figure I remember was $4 billion in terms of fraud was not going to be investigated because it was just written off. And we know the total cost of the pandemic response, I believe, was in excess of $27 billion. And that's $27 billion that never left the NHS with an extra bed or an extra member of staff. All that money pumped into building these Nightingale hospitals that didn't actually treat anybody, and also subsidizing the private hospitals to maintain their existence because they weren't seeing any patients. So the public was subsidizing the sort of private sector and creating capacity which was never used, and paying through the nose for an expensive, ineffective vaccine that we were being forced and coerced into taking. Coercion by means of you couldn't attend university if you weren't vaccinated, you couldn't travel if you weren't vaccinated, potentially you would lose your job if you weren't vaccinated, and this affected, I believe it was 30,000 care workers who lost their jobs because they refused to take the vaccine. And there was a threat to about 100,000 health workers who were mandated to take the vaccine, but at the last minute the government had a change of heart given the negative press and increasing resistance that they were facing.
Yeah, so it's a bit of brinkmanship there that you're talking about, but there are so many aspects, it's almost difficult to know where to start. Well, you have made a very good start, but the propaganda side of things, I just wonder if there's anything specifically on the medical side of things that you would criticise, such as, for example, we had these protocols laid down, global protocols, which some say were actually injuring those that had the virus rather than helping them.
Yeah, so if I just reflect on my personal experience, so, you know, in a health crisis, it doesn't actually make a lot of sense to shut down community and primary care. And that's what was in effect done. We were told to more or less close our doors. Now, I refused to do that. I carried on seeing patients. I took sensible precautions, increased ventilation, avoid a crowded waiting room. But I carried on seeing patients. But actually, people were so terrified, they weren't coming. So the activity rate was dramatically down. In fact, it was the Project Fear was so effective that people suffering heart attacks and strokes stayed at home. Because remember, one of the lines of the propaganda was, stay at home to protect the NHS. Well, hang on, I thought the NHS was here to protect us. So there was an insane period of communication going on. The amount of money being thrown at GP surgeries to administer the vaccine was also something of note. So approximately £12 to £14 was available per shot administered in primary care. So this was actually a bonanza, financial bonanza, for the doctors and surgeries who had hidden away from their patients, who were all of a sudden very happy to see their patients, to scoop up the bonanza of cash. Now, as soon as the vaccines became available, patients were literally knocking the door and knocking down the door to get in and get their vaccine. So although I was skeptical, I took a pragmatic approach that if I wasn't going to give it to them, they would be getting it from somewhere else. And at that point, my concern regarding the vaccine hadn't really matured. Personally, my practice, we administered two vaccines. But by the time that had taken place, I was in contact with a cardiologist called Asim Malhotra, who's been around the world campaigning against, you know, on the harms of the vaccine. He actually asked me to read a paper he had done based on the Pfizer's original research. And what struck me was that Pfizer's own data, which them and the government chose to hide from the public for 75 years, which only came out due to legal action, their own figures quoted severe adverse event rates, i.e. hospitalization or death, of 1 in 800. Now, this is outrageously high. Other vaccines have been pulled with a death rate of 1 in 100,000. So for Pfizer and governments to know that sort of adverse event rate being so high, for that vaccine to be administered to anybody was unheard of. So now we knew we had a dangerous vaccine with a high side effect rate. I had also by that time started to see some of my patients with odd symptoms after vaccination. The most common one was menstrual irregularity in women. I also had a few cases of autoimmune conditions and Bell's palsy, which I'd never, a cluster of Bell's palsies, which I'd never come across in 30 years of practice. And by the time I'd read this paper by Dr. Asim Malhotra, I said, I can't in good conscience administer any more vaccines because I know too much. I can no longer ignore what was happening to my patients and this evidence that he presented, very powerful evidence. So at that
I mean, if you're not going to give your patients the jab, surely you've got to have some sort of alternative. And if you do that, it might be, you know, I'll take vitamin C, and you could be seen as some almost kind of primitive doctor from hundreds of years ago. You're not interested in this amazing cutting-edge new technology. What's the alternative?
Yeah, so there are alternatives, but by that time people were already getting a bit fed up of the vaccines. They were told, have one shot and you'll be protected. Then later on they were told to have a second shot. And, you know, more and more people were noticing that, hang on, the vaccine didn't protect me. I've got COVID again. So the credibility amongst the public of the vaccine's effectiveness was already diminishing. The uptake was diminishing also each time there was a new shot announced. But what I later discovered was that there were interventions that were known to be effective, but these were deliberately blocked in order for the vaccine to gain what is called emergency use authorization in America. For that to happen, you have to argue that there is no other effective treatment. So it was important for governments across the world to demonize certain repurposed drugs like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. And people who did advocate those therapies were smeared. They were cancelled off social media. And in some cases, they lost their jobs if they were doctors or nurses. So there was a very heavy price to pay. And unfortunately, the propaganda was so universal, powerful and repetitive that for anybody to say something different, they run the risk of regulatory sanction or losing the confidence of the patients, because people have been brainwashed. They have in fact been psychologically inoculated against the truth.
Wow. Well, look, you've just mentioned two drugs there, hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Hydroxychloroquine, as I understand it, is mainly used to protect against malaria in malarial areas, and ivermectin against worms and things like that, parasites in one's body. So how on earth can either of these be of any use to a respiratory disease? It just sounds completely ridiculous.
Well, so coming to ivermectin won the Nobel Prize for Medicine back in the 90s. It's very cheap. It's a generic drug. And it has been shown to have antiviral activity. So to discredit this drug was obscene. Hydroxychloroquine, you correctly point out, is a malaria prevention drug. It's also used in rheumatological conditions. And that too has been shown to have antiviral properties. So, and both of these drugs have been taken for decades and have known to be safe if taken, you know, at normal doses. So the government and the propaganda machine went out of their way to actually smear these drugs, which are well known to be safe for humans. They're also used in animals, and you're right, they are used for parasitic infections. But as with many drugs, such as anti-epileptic drugs that we often use for pain control, antidepressants we often use for pain control. So this is a what we call repurposing drugs, using drugs not for their original intention, but found to be effective in other conditions.
Well, that sounds to me like a kind of serendipitous side effect that actually the drug has several potential purposes. But at the end of the day, what do you think was going on here? Can you give us any insight? Because it sounds either like some kind of conspiracy against the public, or else just simply horrendous bad management by Matt Hancock and his friends.
Well, I think this wasn't a UK issue. This was a global issue. It was well planned. All the evidence is pointing to the original virus having gain of function performed on it, either in America or in China. Although there was a worldwide moratorium on gain of function research, it still took place. That might explain why Anthony Fauci has been given a presidential pardon, going back to 2014. So he's beyond sort of accountability now. And the US has been performing sort of biological warfare research for decades. And I believe it was an issue that they had something like 50 labs in Ukraine also working on biological weapons repurposing gain of function research. So less and less people are arguing that this is some sort of conspiratorial thinking. There's more and more evidence. There were Senate committees into the origins of the virus. In fact, Fauci and his colleagues doubled down their efforts to discredit anybody who dared to say this was coming from a lab. And now we know the truth. It did come from a lab. And we can speculate as to why they would do this. I've heard people say there's some sort of Malthusian intent behind these the virus and also the vaccination. I have no evidence of that, but I've heard it mentioned. And more recently, I'm coming to learn that not only was the vaccine ineffective with a high side effect rate, well, actually, it seems to be doing longer term damage. There was a recent Yale study which seems to be proposing that a lot of these what were labeled long COVID, i.e. taking a long time to recover from the COVID infection, were actually vaccine-related side effects. So there was a paper published just a few weeks ago saying that there's a whole category of various symptoms which can be put down to a vaccine-related syndrome.
And, yeah, sorry, before we continue, I think it's useful for if listeners have got loved ones, friends or whatever that have had what they suspect might be related to the vaccine. Is there anything that we know has been related to the COVID jabs at all that will at least give you a clue as to whether or not maybe some sort of side effect may be related to the jabs?
Well, there are various categories. You have inflammatory conditions like myocarditis. You can have clotting problems, so causing heart attacks and strokes. And there's another category of autoimmune disorders and neurological disorders. So there's a broad range of side effects. In fact, Pfizer's own trials mentioned many of these potential side effects, and that's now in the public domain. So, but what worries me more is there is evidence that the jabs alter how your immune system functions. So your immune system has a limited capacity, and multiple jabs skew the immune system to produce antibodies and detract it away from a very important cancer surveillance element of the immune system. So there is a worry that this may have a knock-on effect in increased cancer rates. So those are sort of main issues of autoimmunity, inflammation, clotting, and potentially a greater risk of cancer over time.
Yeah, so one of the most worrying concerns about all of this, Bill, Bob, is the way that the medical profession have been complicit in treatments, which may well be, in fact, I think we know they are, detrimental to the patients. And I wonder if there's anything you think that listeners can do to try and make sure that when they're getting medical advice in the future, that they don't get that advice, which is really just coming from a press release from a pharmaceutical company, that it really is independent.
I think it's very difficult because we have regulatory capture. The MHRA, who approves drugs, the people who write the recommendations, NICE and others, National Institute of Clinical Excellence, unfortunately, they all went along with the vaccination drive, the expansion of who it should be given to, the support of mandates, for example. And they haven't actually come clean about how wrong this was. And these regulators are very powerful. They can stop people's careers in their tracks. So we have a problem. Doctors and nurses cannot speak freely because of fear of career damage. And until that changes, it's very difficult to know whether your health professional is just regurgitating a protocol derived from above or is actually giving you their genuinely held medical belief. I suppose one litmus test might be to ask your doctor to, their views on the whole COVID jab and see whether they're actually anywhere approaching the reality, or are they still brainwashed with the dominant narrative?
Yes, very good advice. There are also some pretty good websites. I think people like the Children's Health Defence. Maybe you could give us a list of places to go to maybe get, I suppose, a more reliable narrative, because there's been quite a lot of kooky quacks out there as well, saying all sorts of rather strange things along the sort of David Icke lines. So are there any, can you actually recommend a few websites for us before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I think the other group that have done a lot of good work, there's a Dr. Peter McCullough. So he's a cardiologist. He's been prolific in terms of producing content. He's on certainly, I see most of his stuff on Twitter or X. There's a group, the abbreviation is FLCCC. Don't ask me to tell you what it stands for, but this is a collaboration of medics across the world who produce their own protocols and advice regarding COVID and other things. There's a Dr. Paul Marrick, who's written a book on the use of repurposed drugs, particularly in cancer care. So the other thing to potentially look at is my Twitter feed, because I share a lot of the stuff that I think is of interest and of value. And my Twitter handle is at Dr. Bob Gill.
Okay, Bob. Fantastic. Thanks ever so much for joining us. I wonder if you could just leave us with one thought, and that is there any hope for the National Health Service? It does seem as if it's been going through this process of really slow privatisation, and I know you've been really championing it as a public service.
There's always hope, but that hope can only come from a critical mass of the public waking up to what's happened and demanding change. Only then will our political masters act, because they're not going to do it in any other scenario, particularly given their very close links to big pharma, big money, and US health corporations and insurers. This has to come from the public demand. And you know, that's why I've been spending my energy trying to inform and educate as many people as possible.
Okay, could you just remind us of your X handle again?
It's at Dr. Bob Gill. And please, people look up my film on YouTube called The Great NHS Heist, which explains the stealth privatisation in a lot more detail.
Okay, Dr. Bob Gill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.